We're going to begin our time today in 2 Kings chapter 5. So if you want to go ahead and start turning there. Now, if you were to make a trip to Cooperstown, New York, and stop by the National Baseball Hall of Fame and Museum, you could see the ball that broke Hank Aaron's home run record. You would also see that that ball has been defaced. It's had an asterisk cut into it, laser etched into it. The ball was donated to the museum by a fashion designer who purchased it for $752,000. And then he asked fans in a big online poll to decide the fate of the ball. And 47% of the fans voted that the ball should be adorned with an asterisk. 34% said you should just leave it alone and donate it, as is. 19% wanted to shoot it into space. Now, why did so many fans want such a historic artifact to be either defaced or destroyed? Does anybody know? Any baseball fans in here? The reason is because the person who hit the home run that broke Hank Aaron's record was Barry Bonds. And Barry Bonds, though he was a great baseball player, was embroiled in a performance-enhancing drug controversy. Okay? So, as Bonds began to approach this record of Hank Aaron's, this home run record, and was looking, you know, he's right on trajectory to beat it, fans proposed the idea of adding an asterisk to note that there was a blot on his account. Because he's been juicing, he's been using these before. You know, he beat the record, but really, you know, he used help to do it. He's a great ball player, but he had an asterisk by his name. He had a blot on his account. Now, when we enter our story today, in 2 Kings chapter 5, verse 1, we're going to be introduced to a man with a literal blot on his record. His name is Naaman. Pick it up with me in 2 Kings chapter 5, verse 1. Now, Naaman, captain of the army of the king of Aram, was a great man before his master, highly respected because by him the Lord had given victory to Aram. The man was also a valiant warrior, a leper. He's a 5-star general of the Aramean army. His name, Naaman, means pleasant. And he undoubtedly was a pleasant man. He's favored by everybody, even everybody we come across him today in the story. He's a great man before the king. He's respected by the people. His servants, as we'll find, genuinely seek and care for his well-being. Even those whom he's captured as spoils of war, they're won over by him. They care for his well-being. All the same, he was a leper. He was a general, but a leprous general. He had an asterisk. Now, when we come in the biblical story and we encounter leprosy, we have to ask ourselves, now, what is leprosy? What are we really talking about here? The modern use of the term leprosy refers to something known as Hansen's disease. Normally, when you think of leprosy, you think of a skin disease, but Hansen's disease is really a neurological disease. It affects your nervous system. It causes disfigurement of the skin and the bones, twisting of the limbs, curling of the fingers into the form of a claw, a collapsing of the nose, thickening of the earlobes. It's a terrible disease. The biblical use, now Hansen's disease is a modern use of the term. Okay, it wasn't until the 19th century that we identified that particular disease as leprosy. Okay. So the biblical use of the term is going to cover a broader spectrum of ailments. Okay? It's going to include Hansen's disease for sure, but generally any person who has a scaly skin blemish or raw flesh is exposed or running sores, all of these kind of things are going to be considered leprous as far as the Bible is concerned. The condition is going to be detailed in Leviticus chapter 13. I'm going to turn there because I'm going to read just a portion of it for you in a minute. But the condition is actually extended to mold and to rot and blemishes that you'll find in leather and in clothing and on your house. So when we talk about leprosy in the Bible, really we're talking, it's framed in terms of being unclean. Okay? A leper is unclean. They want to be clean. It's not really thought of as in the idea of being sick and I want to be healed. It is unclean. I want to be made clean. Now, as for the fate of those in Israel, they had a particular statute for those who were considered lepers in the land. They were quarantined. Listen to what happens to them. This is Leviticus 13, verse 45. As for the leper who has the infection, his clothes shall be torn, and the hair of his head shall be uncovered, and he shall cover his mustache and cry, "Unclean, unclean." He shall remain unclean all the days during which he has the infection. He's unclean. He shall live alone. His dwelling place shall be outside of the camp. They are isolated. They are outcasts. They have to walk. I mean, that's how I felt like walking around screaming unclean recently. It's just horrible sickness. But I can't imagine. Okay, that was an internal problem. That was congestion. These guys are physically, outwardly suffering. It is painful. In Numbers 12, you might remember as we were going through the story, Aaron and Miriam, Moses' brother and his sister, tried to put Moses in check. They said, you know, who made you the boss of everybody? You know, we can speak for God too. You remember what happened? Miriam got struck with leprosy. And this is how it's the way that Aaron speaks of it. He's pleading with Moses. He's like, oh my goodness, please don't do this to Miriam. And he says, do not let her, this is Numbers 12:12. He says, do not let her be like one dead, whose flesh is half eaten away when she comes from his mother's womb. Leprosy is paired with death in Scripture. There's no cure. There is no cure for leprosy. You just go outside of the camp and maybe the Lord will heal you. Maybe he won't. But only the Lord can heal leprosy. You're not going to go to a doctor. You're not going to go to the priest. The priest can identify leprosy. He can't cure leprosy. So to be delivered would be equivalent to being made alive. You're suddenly restored back to the community, to the society. You have your life back again. Now, regardless of how it manifested itself back to 2 Kings, of how it manifested itself in Naaman's life, it's safe to say that pleasant wasn't very pleasant to look at. It might have just been eczema, but whatever it was most likely painful. It was a physical blemish for sure that was disrupting his life. And he was willing to go to great lengths to have this leprosy removed if the opportunity ever arose. Which makes it all the more surprising, really, that Naaman holds such power and such respect in the eyes of his people. He's a Gentile. He's with the king of Aram, so they might not have the particular quarantine law that Israel has. But nonetheless, I mean, this is a guy, you look at him and he's disfigured, at least in his skin, but nonetheless, everyone holds him highly. Now, as the saying goes, if you see a turtle on the fence post, right, you know he didn't get there by himself. So if you see a leper here, he's this guy who's not attractive to look at because he looks disfigured, but he's in a high political office. How did he get there? Well, the text doesn't let us wonder. The strange situation is explained in the very first verse. We're told that he was used by God. A pagan who doesn't worship Yahweh, doesn't believe in Yahweh, isn't following Yahweh. He was used by Yahweh to give victory to Aram. Oh, now that is a very interesting statement. Victory over who, do you think? You know, we're not really tracking the life and times of the pagan nations in the story, right? We're really interested in one nation in the story, Israel. Now they're split into Israel and Judah, but we're only really interested in them. And the only reason we're really interested in them is because we got a problem. We're going to die. And the deliverer, the one who's going to fix our problem, is coming through Israel. That's the only reason we care about them. So I'm not really interested normally in the life and times of what's going on in Gentile nations, unless those Gentile nations are related to Israel. And we know that they are. Normally, Israel's supposed to be ruling and blessing the nations. They have the word that brings cleansing. They have the word of Yahweh, and they're supposed to be a light to the nations and blessing the nations. But when they're going after other gods, gods in whom there is no deliverance, then one of the ways that the Lord has promised to chastise them is with the nations. You won't be the head. You'll be the tail. The other nations will be the head. And they'll come and they'll raid you. Those fields that you planted, they'll eat them. They'll take your children. They'll take your houses. They'll take your wives. They'll take your stuff until you're ready to repent. So here, now we're talking about a nation. We're told that the Lord has given victory through this man to Aram. And we're asking, victory over who? An interesting thing is that, you know what rabbinic thought, what the rabbis tie this to? You may recall, the current king of Israel, his father was Ahab. Ahab, the husband of Jezebel, the no good king of Israel that was constantly bumping into Elijah, right? Do you remember how Ahab met his end a couple weeks ago? Listen to it. 1 Kings 22. This is the very end of 1 Kings. This is how things go down with Ahab. Now, Ahab wants to go to war with Aram. This is the last war that Israel has with Aram. And he wants to recover some land. And he convinces the king of Judah to come and help him recover this land. And, of course, all his prophets are encouraging him to go and try and take this land. And we know that's because the Lord has sent a lying spirit into these pagan prophets to go get Ahab into trouble, because he's been rebelling against God. Well, he goes, they go into the war, and notice the strategy of the king of Aram. Chapter 22, verse 31, the king of Aram had commanded his 32 captains of his chariot, saying, "Do not fight with small or great, but with the king of Israel alone." He says, "Look, I don't care. I just want Ahab dead. Okay, I don't care about anything else. I'm done with this guy." And you might remember when Ahab went to battle, he disguised his appearance because Elijah has already told him, "You're going down." Or maybe no, it wasn't Elijah. It was Micaiah. The prophet of the Lord's already told him, "You're going down." So he disguises himself, but he allows Jehoshaphat to go in looking like a king. Well, when the captains see Jehoshaphat, they all think he is Ahab and they go after him until they realize he's not the guy. Well, what happened to Ahab? Look at it, verse 34. "Now, a certain man drew his bow at random and struck the king of Israel in the joint of the armor." So he has to pull out of battle and he dies from the injury. Now, so the rabbis think, based on this text, this is the most recent battle that Aram had with Israel, and the victory was given in the battle by a certain man who just randomly drew the bow and took a shot, and the Lord gave Aram victory by directing that little guided missile of an arrow right into the joint of Ahab's armor to kill him. So they think that this was Naaman, and that because of this great victory, he's been promoted. So you have this leper, this nobody, now is suddenly a great man of esteem amongst his people. That's very possible. There's, you know, good literary reason to think that. It's also just possible the Lord used him in other victories. I'd like to think the former. I'm not sure about it, but I'm putting it out there for you to consider. Now, whatever the case is, he's respected. He's in this high place of honor. Why do we care about him? Well, the plot thickens. Pick it up in verse 2. "Now, the Arameans had gone out in bands and had taken captive a little girl from the land of Israel. And she was before Naaman's wife. And she said to her mistress, 'I wish that my master were before the prophet who is in Samaria. Then he would cure him of his leprosy.'" So we have Naaman, who's the great man, before his master, this little girl from Israel who's been captured, who's serving before Naaman's wife. And she says, "Well, I wish Naaman was before that prophet in Israel, the one who speaks for Yahweh. He'd cure him." What's going on with this little girl? Now, the media would say she has Stockholm syndrome. Have y'all ever heard of that before? Stockholm syndrome? It's that situation where a victim who has been involved in either a hostage situation or kidnapping is suddenly starting to identify and have feelings or trust or affection for the people who are holding them captive. Recently, Beauty and the Beast is coming out, or has come out, I don't know. And recently I saw some of the media was saying that Belle in Beauty and the Beast, they were saying, well, she has Stockholm Syndrome. That's what we're teaching in Beauty and the Beast. Oh, is that what it is? Is that what's happening here? Is this Stockholm Syndrome? No. So what's going on? Well, it's an interesting situation, really. Was Israel following Yahweh nationally? Nah. No, man, they've been off the tracks for a long time, haven't they? I mean, Jeroboam, remember, right off the bat when they split from Judah, Jeroboam sets up those false gods, and they've been having trouble ever since. The molten cow in Bethel and Dan, yeah, that was a great idea. So no, they're not following Yahweh nationally. They're not drawing the nations to worship the one true God. The message isn't going out. So the Lord allows a little girl to be captured who is a believer. Now, this most likely meant that she was taken from believing parents who were either killed or they're, you know, bereaved of their daughter. Yeah, I'm thinking of, it's not their fault, right? They're following Yahweh, but because of the king's decision and the nation's decision, they're having to suffer the curses, even though they're obedient. It's Romans 8, you might recall. We are put to death all day long for your sake. And Paul is asking the question, who will separate us from the love of Christ? Sword, famine, tribulation, distress? I'm convinced nothing can. But he quotes a psalm where the remnant is saying, Lord, we're following your law. We haven't broke any of these commandments, but we're getting wiped out. Our situation is dire because these yahoos are following pagan gods. They won't listen to us. The Lord says, it's okay. I'm going to resurrect you. I'm going to resurrect you. I'm going to sort this thing out. But right now, things aren't looking sorted out. And we have a little girl who's a believer, has been captured. And through her goes knowledge of the one true God into Aram. And then the Lord uses her, this little girl, to bring the message of the one true God to a Gentile in this land, the general of the army. It reminds me of an interesting phenomenon we're dealing with in our highly connected world today. We think of the Great Commission. Go and make disciples of all nations. Make students of Christ of all nations. But there are some places where Christianity is illegal, right? There are some places that you can't get in. It's dangerous to be a Christian. In fact, there are some places, if you're an American, you know, you'll be killed, most likely on sight. You're not going to be running around openly, you know, on a soapbox sharing the gospel in Somalia and Libya and Iraq and North Korea. I mean, how many of you in this room plan on doing missions work in your lifetime in North Korea? None. Is it possible that in some countries where we can't enter to bring the message of Yahweh to the people, that God just might bring the people to us through immigration, perhaps? Not talking about legal or illegal immigration. I couldn't care less. We got to remember our government is a Gentile secular government. America isn't the kingdom. Not concerned about that. I'm saying, theologically for us, if we're unable, or in some cases unwilling, to take Yahweh's message to North Korea, should we be upset if Yahweh provides us with an opportunity by bringing a North Korean to us? Just saying. We can drink sweet tea and minister to people who would kill us if we were in their own country. It's a win-win, right? We don't even have to leave our home. It's an interesting phenomenon today. I mean, people are fleeing these countries in droves. Opportunities at our front door. Now, in our passage, the Lord has done that through a little girl by being taken by force, brought into this Gentile nation, and ministering to the leader of the army, maybe the one that killed her parents or captured her. Naaman takes this message. It comes to him through his wife. He hears what this little girl is saying about Israel. He tells the king of Aram that there's a prophet in Israel, or so this little girl says. And so the king of Aram writes a nice little letter, sends Naaman along to go visit the king of Israel. And he goes and he gives him the letter, and basically the king of Aram says, well, I've sent my general to you. He's bringing all kinds of gifts and stuff to give as a present. He says, we'd like you to heal him. And the king of Israel is saying, what on earth are you talking about? He thinks he's trying to pick a fight. Look at it. Verse 7. He says, am I God to kill and make alive that this man is sending to me to cure him of his leprosy? Consider now, he's seeking a quarrel against me. This thing can't be done. What are you talking about? You know, what a contrast. Apparently, a little POW who's suffering curses because of the rebellion of the king knows of a prophet in Israel who gives life that the king who is dwelling in Israel in riches and comfort doesn't know about. Now, is it possible that the king doesn't know about Elisha? No. He's actually had some encounters with him. Elisha's been doing a variety of miracles along the way. In fact, he helped give this particular king victory just a couple chapters ago. He's aware of Elisha. But what does it tell you about the king's regard for Elisha? He doesn't regard Elisha. He doesn't regard his word. Now, what does it tell you about his regard for the God that Elisha represents? Yeah, he doesn't regard him either. See, Elisha and Yahweh are thick as thieves, okay? They're like this. His word is one and the same. He's sitting in that spot right now, okay? The kings, when David was on the scene, remember, David and God were like this. David's word was as God's word. But not too long after David, remember, the kings came on, they said, we don't have any future with you, house of David. We're going to go do our own thing. And right then, this whole thing started to go sideways, right? So the Lord has started sending prophets who are now sitting in that spot, who are representing him and his word, and they're trying to keep this whole thing from ending up in the ditch. So how the kings are responding to the prophets, remember the southern kings? You remember a couple weeks ago, the southern king went to battle with Ahab? And Ahab said, well, you know, we're going to battle. We're going to take this land. Here are my prophets. They all say things are going good. What does he want to do? Is there not a prophet of Yahweh around here we can ask to see how this thing is going to go? Same thing happens again with this particular king. It's a couple chapters before this. They're going to battle again. Can we not consult the prophet of Yahweh to see how this is going to go? There's still some light in the southern kingdom. Northern kingdom, they're just completely off the rails. Okay? Now, so he's concerned. He says, you know, you're asking this impossible thing of me. He's upset. Naaman's upset. He's got his hopes up. What's going to happen is Elisha is going to hear. See, the king is going to, he's frustrated. He's tearing his clothes. He's mourning because he thinks now he has to go to battle. But Elisha gets word of it. He sends a servant to the king. He says, look, you just send him my way. Send him my way so that, notice it, verse 8, he shall know that there is a prophet in Israel. You don't recognize that the word of the Lord resides in Israel. Who's the message going to? Gentile. Message going to the Gentile. The Gentiles will know if you won't recognize it, O king. So Naaman comes his way. Pick it up in verse 9. Naaman comes with his horses, with his chariots, and stands at the doorway of the house of Elisha. Elisha sent a messenger to him saying, go and wash in the Jordan 7 times and your flesh will be restored to you and you'll be clean. But Naaman was furious. And he went away and said, behold, I thought he would surely come out to me and stand and call on the name of Yahweh, his God, and wave his hand all over the place and cure the leper. Are not Abana and Pharpar, the rivers of Damascus, better than all the waters of Israel? I mean, could I not wash in them and be clean? So he turned and went away in a rage. Naaman arrives with his entourage, and he is expecting Elisha to come out and display the same kind of theatrics that he's used to, the same kind of religious pomp and rituals that he's used to. Remember when Elijah was contending with the prophets of Baal on Mount Carmel, and they're running around and screaming, and they're cutting themselves, and they're doing all kinds of crazy things. That's what he's looking for. Instead, he encounters Elisha's servant. He doesn't even see Elisha. And the servant just brings him Elisha's word. And says, verse 10, look, go to the Jordan. Dunk in there 7 times. You'll be clean. Huh? Now, we haven't made our trip to Israel, but I've heard the Jordan is a very dirty, murky, unremarkable little stream. He's saying, okay, if I could be cleansed by taking a bath, there are some clean rivers in Damascus I could go and take a bath in and be clean. What are you talking about? Well, am I going to go dunk down in the dirty river in Israel? I mean, do you not understand the enormity of what I'm asking you? I came to be cleansed of leprosy. You're telling me to dunk in the Jordan River? Now, a lot of people make a lot about Naaman's pride. Like, oh, well, he was looking for the rivers that were greater rivers. And it's because the Jordan was not a greater river. Now, pride certainly is an issue for Naaman. But I really think the issue, based on his statement, you know, I thought he was going to come out and do these various things. It seems that the problem he's hung up on is religious ritualism. He has an idea of how this is supposed to go. It doesn't follow his paradigm for how to worship a god, and he's put off by it. I think of Hudson Taylor. Have any of y'all heard of Hudson Taylor before? He's a prophet. He's a missionary to China. Okay, he broke ground in China, and the way that he found that he needed to minister to them was to really give up some of the social norms he brought with him from Western culture. He found that when he was out trying to preach the gospel, the Chinese really weren't interested in the gospel. They were fascinated at the strange clothes he was wearing and the buttons that didn't really seem to serve any purpose. They weren't listening to his message. They were evaluating his culture. So what he ends up doing is removing things that were, in his mind, a barrier to the message and assimilating into their culture. He even ended up dyeing his hair. You know, he was a fair-haired looking guy. He's like, anything I can do to remove these barriers. And he caught a ton of flack from the Western missionary societies for it, because they thought it made Western culture look inferior to the Eastern culture. You're capitulating to these people. He's saying, what does this have to do with our message? What does the Western culture have to do with this faith that spawned in Jerusalem? What are you talking about? And he was able to minister and break ground through this ecumenical. He's reaching out to other denominations, making a non-denominational society, missionary society, whose idea is to go and integrate into the culture in order to bring the message to that culture. Naaman here has this expectation, this pagan ritual. He thinks, and His servants even bring him to account for it. Look at verse 13. They come near to him. They tell him, look, my father, had the prophet told you to do some great thing, wouldn't you have done it? How much more then when he says to you, wash, be clean? They say, look, if he asked you to come and do something crazy, you know you'd have tried to do it. If he told you to go and climb some weird spiritual ladder, you'd have tried to do it. You'd have jumped through the hoops. If he told you to go on a pilgrimage somewhere, you'd have done it. If he'd have told you to hop around on one leg with a chicken, you'd have done it. He's just asked something simple. Why not just do it? And interestingly enough, he heeds their rebuke. Verse 14. So he went down. And he dipped himself 7 times in the Jordan, according to the word of the man of God. And his flesh was restored like the flesh of a little child, and he was clean. What made Naaman clean? It wasn't the water, right? We can at least agree it wasn't this muddy, nasty water in the Jordan stream, Jordan River. It wasn't a religious ritual. It wasn't the prophet. Notice it, verse 14. He acted according to the word of the man of God. He followed the word of the man of God. It was the word that made his flesh clean. Clean like a little child, like the little girl. Like the little Israelite. Now, he wasn't just clean on the outside. Naaman had a conversion. Notice it, verse 15, when he returned to the man of God, what was his conclusion? Behold, now I know that there is no God in all the earth but in Israel. And he tries to give him a present. He's clean, cleansed without, he's cleansed within. Total conversion. In fact, he even wants to take dirt back with him when he goes back to Aram. Not because the dirt in Israel is holier than the dirt in Aram. He's actually trying to follow the law. It suggests that he has a little bit more of a dialogue than we're included in the scene. The author's only included in the scene what's necessary for us to follow the movement. He wants, it's Exodus 20:24. You know, you're supposed to build an altar out of earth. He says, well, I want to do that. And he wants to remember this conversion experience that he's had here. He even asks for a pardon from the prophet. He says, will Yahweh give me a pardon when I go back? Because now I know that there's no God but Yahweh. But my master doesn't know that. And part of my duty is I have to go with him when he goes in the temple to worship this non-God. And he's going to lean on me and want to worship. He says, I don't believe in that God. But it's now part of my duty. I have to at least bow with him. Will the Lord pardon me? I'm not worshiping him, but I'm caught in this situation and I don't know what to do. And he receives the pardon. Elisha seems to imply, he says, look, go in peace. Go in peace. And he wants to give Elisha a gift. All this money, all these changes of clothes he's brought. Look, I want to thank you. I want to pay homage to you and to the God that you represent. But notice this. Elisha's answer, as Yahweh lives, before whom I stand. Remember, the captain stands before his master. The girl stands before the wife. She wants him to stand before the prophet. He is now. He says, look, I stand before Yahweh, and I'm not going to take anything. Why? Elisha has taken gifts in the past. Why not now? Well, first of all, he didn't do anything, right? It was the Lord that healed Naaman. That's part of the point. He sends his servant out to bring the word. He's like, I don't want there to be any confusion here. You've heard that a prophet can heal. Well, actually, it's Yahweh that heals. Okay, I'm his servant, but nonetheless, I don't want you to get confused. Secondly, the cleansing that the Lord offers is a free gift, not to be added to. The problem is, he wants to add to it, or we often at times even want to add to it, whether it be through religious ritual, works. Unfortunately, Elisha's servant runs into the same problem at the end of this story. Look at it, verse 20. But Gehazi, the servant of Elisha, the man of God, thought, behold, my master has spared this Naaman the Aramean by not receiving from his hands what he brought. As Yahweh lives, I will run after him and take something from him. He's going to add to it. He's going to add a stipulation to this reception of the word of the prophet. It's Galatians, if you're not hearing it. Paul's bringing this message to these Gentiles, grace through faith. And now they're being bugged by these Jewish legalists who are saying, yeah, Jesus is okay, but you got to be circumcised. He says, I wish those guys would mutilate themselves. If they're bringing you any kind of other gospel, let them be accursed. He says, you guys, you Galatian believers, did you receive the Spirit through works of the law or through hearing with faith? Hearing with faith. These guys over here, do they have the Spirit? Nope. You know what they got? The curse. Look at Gehazi here. Gehazi goes, he catches Naaman, he asks for some of his stuff, he's given it, he takes it back, hides it. When he goes in and stands, verse 25, before his master, Elisha, Elisha says to Gehazi, where have you been? And he said, your servant went nowhere. Then Elisha said to him, did not my heart go with you when the man turned from his chariot to meet you? Is it a time to receive money and to receive clothes and olive groves and vineyards and sheep and oxen and male and female servants? Therefore, the leprosy of Naaman shall cling to you and to your descendants forever. So he went out from his presence, a leper, white as snow, which suggests Naaman's leprosy, probably similar to that. The very burden lifted from Naaman for accepting the word of the prophet is attributed to Elisha's servant for rejecting the word of the prophet. Your relationship to the prophet, to his word, was determining your relationship to Yahweh. So now the Israelite is under judgment and the Gentile has been freed. How are we supposed to understand this text in light of the biblical story? We know the story is moving, right? This is Old Testament. We're looking for Jesus. Jesus comes on the scene. How does Jesus take this text to relate to the story? Listen to Luke chapter 4. Luke chapter 4, and I'm going to read to you verses 24 through 27. Jesus is speaking to a crowd in Israel. And this is the point where he's quoted from the book of Isaiah. He's like, look, the Spirit of the Lord is upon me because he anointed me to preach the gospel to the poor. He sent me to proclaim release to the captives, recovery of sight to the blind, to set free all who are oppressed, to proclaim the favorable year of the Lord. And they're saying great things about him. He stops midpoint in that prophecy. He doesn't go to the part about judgment. And they're saying all kinds of good things. And he's saying, he changes his tone to them in verses 23. He says to these onlookers, no doubt you'll quote this proverb to me, physician, heal yourself. Whatever we heard was done at Capernaum, do here at your hometown as well. We've heard you've been performing signs and wonders, but if that's true, well, do a trick for us as well, that we might believe. He says to them, truly I say to you, no prophet is welcome in his hometown. But I say to you in truth, there were many widows in Israel in the days of Elijah, when the sky was shut up for 3 years and 6 months, when a great famine came over the land. Yet Elijah was sent to none of them, but only to Zarephath in the land of Sidon, that's a Gentile, a woman who was a widow. And there were many lepers in Israel in the time of Elisha the prophet, and none of them was cleansed, but only Naaman the Syrian. And of course they hear, and now they want to stone him. What's Jesus saying? When Jesus is referencing this passage, how is he saying it's relating to the story? Who had the word that brings cleansing? Elisha, who is in Israel. Israel has the word that brings cleansing. Israel knows about Yahweh. Who's receiving the word that brings cleansing? Who's benefiting? Not Israel. The Gentiles. He's saying, look, just like your fathers rejected the word of the Lord, so the Lord sent that message out to the Gentiles, you guys have the same heart that your fathers did. You're going to reject the word of the Lord, and that word's going to go out to the Gentiles.
You're the same people that your fathers were. That's why they want to kill him. So when he sees it, he sees it interacting in the story. He's seeing the nation going off the rails. And he's seeing that God is, in spite of his people, still bringing his message of healing out. He's serving that function, even though the nation is rebellious. So what about us? We spoke some about this morning. When I think of this cleansing, Jesus actually talks about this as well. John chapter 13. This is the upper room discourse. You might remember in the upper room discourse, Jesus is preparing his disciples. He's saying, look, I'm going away. This is what's going to happen, and this is what your method of operation is going to be when I'm gone. And it starts with him washing the feet of the disciples. This is John chapter 13. Now, you might remember when he starts washing Peter, Peter's all ornery about it, right? You're not washing me, Jesus. Well, if I don't wash you, Peter, then you have no part in me. He said, oh, wash the whole thing then. It's like, Peter, listen. You've been washed, you've bathed, you're clean. You only need to wash your feet. He's going to make that statement in chapter 13. He tells them, you're clean, except for Judas. And we're told in, he says, verse 10 of chapter 13, he who is bathed needs only to wash his feet, but is completely clean, and you're clean, but not all of you, for he knew the one who was betraying him. For this reason, he said, not all of you are clean. And we're left wondering, how did they become clean? Is it foot washing? You know, how are they becoming clean? And I want to know how I can become clean. Well, he doesn't leave them to wonder. He tells them in chapter 15, listen to it. This is verse 3. This is to his disciples. You are already clean because of the word which I spoke to you. Jesus' word made them clean. So the word that they received makes them clean. Now, Jesus isn't here. I can't hear his word. How do I become clean? In chapter 17, verse 8, listen to this. We're told, the words which the Father gave to Jesus, Jesus gave to his disciples. And they received this word. And now he's taking them and he is sending them out into the world as his representatives. So when we have Gospels, for example, John. In the beginning was the Word, Jesus. The Word was with God, the Father, and the Word was God. And the Word became flesh and tabernacled among us. Who? The disciples. And we, the disciples, beheld his glory. The glory of the only begotten. And we, the disciples, 1 John, proclaim to you so that you may have fellowship with us. And indeed, our fellowship is with the Father and with his Son, Jesus Christ. The same situation you see with Elisha, God's representative bringing God's word of cleansing, to which Naaman is benefiting from, you are benefiting from today through the apostolic witness. That's what the Gospels are. That's what the epistles are. That's how we hear about Jesus and his word. And when you hear, if you receive, like man, you're cleansed. And now we have that word of cleansing, that apostolic testimony, to share with others. Maybe even some that the Lord is displacing from their rebellious nations to put in our backyard.